I'm speaking with Claudia Mullen, a survivor of U.S. government mind control experimentation and operation. Thanks very much for joining us today, Claudia.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
Now, we had heard some of your testimony that was given on the presidential hearings on radiation experiments in 1995. How did you get involved in testifying at those hearings?
Well, I'll tell you, it came about because of the information that I had given my therapist as the memories started coming back to me, and it was obvious that it was more than just abuse by my mother and even ritual abuse here in New Orleans, that it involved some kind of government, you know, conspiracy. But the information was sent out by my therapist to some experts across the country to be verified, to see if these people did exist, if there were such projects, that I was naming names that I had no idea who these people were. My therapist didn't know who they were because she doesn't do any reading on this type of, you know, any kind of mind control issues or government conspiracy, that type of thing. So
she sent your material out to people that have done research into
the government? Yes, that she knew was doing research on this.
Right.
Specifically on CIA projects. And they were sending back, yes, that these people did exist, that I was giving information that was not published yet or had only been published through Freedom of Information Act, which I had not filed, obviously.
Right.
This information was also sent along to a man named Wally Cummings, who was in charge of obtaining speakers, but people to give testimony in the Washington hearings.
And was he part of the radiation committee?
He wasn't actually part of the committee. It was his job to interview, to find people that, you know, for the public testimony part.
Right. So he worked for the committee then?
Yeah, he worked for the committee.
Mm-hmm.
And he was interviewing and, you know, finding people that, you know, had something to say. And so he interviewed me over the phone. And he had heard that I had been giving some had been giving some information that obviously was valid and had to do with radiation. And so he asked me if I would be willing to testify. This was about 2 weeks before we were asked to testify. I mean, before we actually had to testify. So I had about 2 weeks' notice. And I was told that I could speak for 10 minutes and give as much information as I could. And so I decided to do it, and I went to Washington and testified, along with my therapist and one of her other clients.
What was the connection, then, between the radiation experiments and mind control experiments that were done to you?
Okay, well, I had heard a lot about, when I was part of the experiments, they didn't necessarily use a lot of radiation on me other than to take x-rays to keep me healthy, to check for, you know, damage, broken bones. But I did overhear quite a bit about radiation experiments they were doing, especially in New Orleans or outside of New Orleans. And so, obviously, it was the same people doing the radiation experiments that were doing the experiments on me. So that was the connection.
Now, this was an incredibly brave thing to go to the presidential hearings to give testimony. And were you aware that this, you were, in effect, breaking the silence for a lot of other survivors of mind control at the time?
At the time, not really. I didn't realize that we were, I didn't realize what a step we were taking. It sort of was the type of thing that you just jump in and do without thinking too much about it, because you're afraid if you think too long and too hard about it, you might change your mind. And you know it's important, but you're not really sure why it's important at the time. You just know that you need to talk about it, and you need to let people know that it did happen. And so, at the time, I didn't feel very brave about it. I was pretty scared, but and I didn't realize the repercussions and what it would mean as far as opening the door for other mind control victims to be able to come forward and talk at the time. I had no idea what it was going to lead to. I just knew that it was important to do, and I was being given an opportunity to talk to people in Washington and tell them that these things had happened and that they shouldn't have happened. And so I did it. I sort of jumped in and did it without thinking.
And how did it feel, the actual experience of giving testimony at the committee?
Oh, pretty scary. Mm-hmm. It felt good afterwards. It was pretty, overwhelming, I'd say it's the best word to describe it. They were very nice to us. You felt like you were being, looked under a microscope, though. Everything that you said was being torn apart and looked at very carefully, and you were questioned a lot, but we kind of expected that. But afterwards, it was such a feeling of relief and surprise. Actually, I was very surprised afterwards at the response that we had. I walked into the room, and I was just a face, Nobody even knew who I was. Well, there were obviously people there from the government. There were CIA people there. There were military. And it was pretty frightening, But I was kind of lost in the crowd. And when I walked out, everybody knew who I was, and there was so much support, especially from the other radiation victims that I testified. And from the committee themselves, they were very supportive.
So you felt that they had received your information and were seriously taking the information that we're hearing seriously from
yes,
you?
Yes, I did.
And was there any follow-up on the part of the committee, or what was that follow-up as it pertains to the mind control?
Well, the reason that I know that they actually listened, even though the recommendations were mainly for the radiation experiments and strictly radiation, and that was what they were looking at, but I know that they listened to us also, because part of the recommendation, which came out in October of 95, was that these particular projects be looked into, and they were all the MKUltra projects that I had named, and that I had given. We were able to give as much testimony in writing as we wanted to. We were only allowed to talk for a certain amount of time, but we could hand in as much information as we could, give them. And so I'd handed in, like 20 pages listing project numbers, names, sub-project numbers, subjects, places, people. And these were actually the project names and numbers that I gave were actually recommended that these files be opened.
Those particular projects? Mm-hmm.
The list that I gave was on there. Now they haven't actually done it yet.
Right.
And I'm told that the reason is because they're waiting for the people involved, for everyone to have died. To be quite frank, that's what they said.
Who had told you this?
They didn't tell me this, of course. Yeah. Nobody got back to us. I found out actually over the internet, but I spoke to one of the experts that has been filing Freedom of Information Acts in my name for these projects that, that I had named, and he said that he was told directly by the CIA that they did not want to start any real investigation on this until all the people had passed away, because they felt like the public would react too strongly, and that the CIA didn't need this right now, or something.
Well, the public would react strongly, and rightly so. Was there any press coverage at all after giving testimony? Or any press contacting you afterwards?
I think there was a brief story, in the Washington paper. But, like I said, the emphasis was on the radiation and on that testimony. But, yeah, there was coverage in local cable shows. We did an interview that night for a local cable access television station in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it was all over the internet afterwards. But much national coverage, no. Like I said, the emphasis was on radiation.
And I understand journalist John Rappaport had compiled your testimony and the other survivors' testimony in a book. How soon afterwards did that happen? And did you have...
Oh, immediately. I mean, mm-hmm. he came out with a book within, I think, 6 months.
Right.
It's called U.S. Mind Control Experiments on Children They Want to Know.
Right.
By John Rappaport. And also, I was contacted by several other people from, one from 2020, and at the time they wanted my therapist and I to appear on a show, and my therapist turned it down, so I turned it down. And a couple of other people, one man from Washington, the columnist, I did an interview with an attorney. So I did some interviews that probably got into local newspapers, but I never really saw them.
Right.
So there were people calling from all over the country. And I had left my number, my therapist number, as my number in Washington, because people were coming up and asking for a card or how to contact me. And at the time, I knew I was taking a risk, so I didn't want to give any personal information. So I gave my therapist phone number and address, and that's how they contacted me.
Right.
Now, I did get some interviews over the phone.
With newspapers again?
And the BBC, too.
Oh, yes.
The BBC did an interview.
And was anything done with that interview?
Yeah, they're still working on the complete show that they're doing. They said it's going to take several years to finish.
Hmm.
Ours is just a small part of it. But it's Jan Klimkowski is the man's name that's doing the show.
Right. I wonder if you can describe briefly how you were introduced into these experimental programs.
Well, I'd say, to my knowledge, I was first introduced in 1958. I was about 8 years old, and I had already been, I'd been adopted at 2 and a half. My adopted mother had been abusing me from the day she adopted me. She allowed her friends to abuse me, and I was sent to a camp where there was, it was mainly a sex ring, I guess you would call it, or a bunch of pedophiles that got together on weekends and holidays and passed kids around. And these same people apparently let the government know, the people from the government that were looking for subjects for children to use in experiments, that's where they would look, in sex rings and adoption agencies. I think they had been looking at me long before the time I was 8 years old, but they were waiting for me to get to a certain age, I guess, to use me. So I first knew about it when I was 8, and I was told that I was going to be tested by some people from the government at Tulane University, and that it was very important, and it was to help stop communism. And I vaguely knew what communism was and that it was a bad thing. So I tried to do the best I could, and I thought I was doing a good thing.
Now, you had mentioned that your mother had known some people at Tulane. What was the connection there?
Well, my mother knew the chairman of the board of Tulane University Medical School, Darwin Fenner. He was in New Orleans society. He was probably, the highest in society that you could get. And my mother was a real social climber. And so she pretty much offered me to Darwin Fenner for anything that he wanted to use me for. And he was the one that ran this camp. It was called the Covington Camp for Boys and Girls. And it was actually his summer home in north of the Lake Pontchartrain near New Orleans, and I was sent over there, and they would dress up in Mardi Gras costumes, because we were used to Mardi Gras, and they do kind of ceremonies, But it was mainly just to scare us, you know, the ceremonies.
What kind of ceremonies?
And he was also good friends with Robert Heath, Dr. Robert Heath, who was head of the neuropsychiatric department at Tulane. And I believe Darwin Fenner wanted to get the grant money that the CIA was offering if Tulane would allow them to use the place for experiments. And so, since he already knew about me, and they were looking for children that are already abused, that's how I got involved, I guess.
Right, and how long did this abuse and experimentation go on with you, with Tulane University?
Oh, well, it went on pretty steadily, quite frequently, until I graduated from high school in 68. And then after that, it was more intermittent, because I was away from home. My mother had died. It was hard to get a hold of me, but they still could contact me, and I still had to go in. And this went on until probably the last time that I remember actually being involved in anything that had to do with the government was 1988, and I was already 38 years old, and right. They were still using me.
So some 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
After this, what were you doing in your life? Were you able to work, or were you going to school?
You see, I had developed DID, or multiple personality disorder, as a very small child, you know, even before I was adopted. Because at the agency where I was, or the orphanage, it was, there were just so many babies and so few people to take care of us that I guess I started splitting as a natural process to kind of to nurture myself, because there wasn't anybody there to do it for me. And so I'd already started splitting back then. And, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
can you repeat the question again?
Were you working after?
Oh, right, okay. Mm-hmm. So, since I had MPD or DID, this allowed me to lead apparently normal life. Go to school. I went to college after high school. I dated, you know. I went into veterinary medicine, became a veterinary technician for 12 and a half years. And pretty much, led an apparently normal life, except for the times that they would get a hold of me. And then they would use the multiple personalities. They would contact one of my personalities that would respond to them. And she would go, you know, back to Tulane or wherever they wanted me to go. But otherwise, I was leading pretty much a life like anybody else, you know. Dated, got married, went to nursing school, and I was just graduated from nursing school the last time, in 1988, mm-hmm. when I told you they used me at some convention they had here in New Orleans.
Now, when did you first realize that you did have dissociative identities? Did that manifest itself in different ways, apart from the ways they were using you?
When I was 7 years old, that's the first real distinct memory I have of knowing that I had children living inside of me, imaginary friends, I called them.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought everyone did. And these friends looked different than I did. They had names, you know, I had named them. Some were stronger than me, some were taller, some were more outgoing, whereas I was a very shy little girl. And so I was aware that there were these kids living inside me, and I thought everyone did. As I got older, I sort of repressed the idea of having imaginary friends, you know. I just sort of forgot about it. And when they came out, I had no knowledge that they were coming out. And then in 1992, when something happened to me that actually brought all these memories back. Then I was diagnosed with MPD. And, of course, I rejected that right away. I denied it, except for the imaginary friends that I said everybody has those. I was really adamant about not having MPD, but after a while there was no getting around the fact that I did.
So how many, do you have an idea of how many identities that were created or that you created within yourself?
I had close to 100, and all but 23 have integrated.
So you still have about 23?
Yes.
Identities. Can you tell us about some of the identities and whether they have helped you in some way or you've helped them?
Oh, yeah, they've all helped me. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why they were created, was to help me,
right.
To help me survive. I had each identity or each personality is created at a time of trauma. That's the only way that they can be created. That's the only way you can split yourself is during a traumatic incident. And that person or that identity comes out in order to do a job for you. In other words, to take pain. If you have to do something that goes completely against your nature, then you create someone to do that for you because obviously you can't do it. If you have to act a certain way and you can't do it yourself, you create someone to do it. It's not a conscious thing. It's an unconscious process, but they're all helpful in the way that, in the sense that they do something for me that I can't do for myself. I have one that gets very, very angry. She can get, you know, she would come out at times when I get furious at my monitor or different people that were hurting me, and she would come out kicking and screaming and trying to bite them. And but I couldn't get angry. I was afraid to get angry, so that's why I had Leslie. She's the one who gets angry. So they all help in the sense that they do something that I'm not capable of doing. But they cannot go against my inherent nature. In other words, none of them would do anything that I would feel is inherently wrong, like to kill somebody. They do things that I'm not capable of doing just because I can't bring myself to do it, but I don't think there's none of them that are bad. Mm-hmm. They're all good.
What was it that started bringing the memories back?
In October of 1992, something happened to me that was completely unrelated to any of this. And I'm told that a lot of victims of child abuse throughout their lives becomes victims of crime, of violent crime, simply because these perpetrators look for people that look like victims. And I became a victim of aggravated rape in my house. I was a nurse working nights, and I came home in the morning, and there was a man waiting for me. And it was pretty traumatic, and I didn't tell anyone at first. I tried to handle it, and obviously I couldn't. I became suicidal and depressed and suicidal, and eventually had to, I told the police, and the police recommended me to a therapist. Mm-hmm. And they recommended me to the therapist that I have now, that I've always had.
Valerie Wolf?
And mainly because she was an expert witness, and they wanted to use her in the trial against the man who had raped me.
I see.
And,
So you were going forward and pressing charges at that time, or?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it took 2.5 years to go to trial. And during that time, I was in therapy, and that's when the memory started coming back. I would say probably about 6 months after the incident happened, these memories started coming that had nothing to do with the rape. That, well, obviously things that happened when I was a child, and at first it was just my mother that I remembered, the way she abused me, and then it would be people that I remember from my childhood, and then it started to be memories of strangers, people that I didn't know, mainly doctors, people in uniforms, military uniforms. I would be in a place that I don't remember ever going to, like Maryland. I never thought I'd been to Maryland, and I was having memories of being there, and these people hurting me, doing things to me, taking tests, being in front of a large group of an audience of people, and having to perform different things. And these are the kind of memories that started coming back, and they came back very fast. Once the memories start, once you're triggered to remember, they don't come out in a timely fashion. They just come crashing out, and you're so overwhelmed that if you're not in therapy already, then you end up in the hospital, probably because of a suicide attempt, because that's the first thing you want to do is kill yourself. Before you can deal with this.
Right.
Because nobody wants to believe this really happened to them. And then when the memories are so real and so vivid that you know it must have happened, and then you check out information and find out that this place does exist, that this person was a real person, then there's no way of getting around the fact that it was a real memory. You try everything you can to prove that they're false, that they didn't really happen, that you made this person up in your mind. But when it's proved to you that they are real, accurate memories, then you have to start dealing with it. And the first thing you do is deny it. And then you try to get away from it. And
so was it you or your therapist that were attempting to verify what information you were remembering?
At first, neither one of us did. The memories just started coming, and then after a while, I started saying, "Well, these didn't happen." You can't prove that they happened. And so she started sending. I started writing all this information down, or my alters, my shadows, I call them, would come out, and they would write down conversations they overheard. They would write down descriptions of places I had been to, things that had happened to me, and they would write it as sort of a letter to me. Remember Claudia, remember when this happened, remember when this colonel came to see us, and they would describe the man, give part of his name. We would remember whole conversations of things. And so she finally said, "Well, I guess we should start trying to find out if this is real or not." She actually didn't try to at first, because she said the whole purpose of therapy is not so much to find out if it's real or not, but to deal with what's coming, what you're remembering, and try to get through it and process it and get past it. It's not really to find out if it's true or not. Mm. It doesn't really matter. If it's happening to you, then it's real enough to you.
So
I wanted to know whether it was real or not. I wanted to know if these people existed. And she had no idea. She had never heard of any of them. She wasn't familiar with the places I was talking about. So she had to send it out to people, all over the country. And she started getting responses back that, yes, she's describing so-and-so. Yes, he was known to be involved in CIA government experiments. And they started calling me and asking me specific questions. And then I would describe people that accurately, people I supposedly had never met, people that had died years ago. I described the inside of places that supposedly I'd never been to, and yet I could describe the inside, what room I'd gone to, what it looked like, things like that. That's how it was verified.
We've been listening to an interview with Claudia Mullen, a survivor of mind control experiments done by the U.S. government. She had referred in her presentation in particular to third person she. She was actually describing herself either at an earlier age or as a different alter of her multiple personalities. I'd like to also announce that this radio series is being rebroadcast on Monday nights at 10 p.m. And this Monday is the second broadcast in the radio series. We're at number 13 this week. And also, for people with web access, you can get transcripts of this radio series at www.mk.net/tildemcf/ckln-hm.htm. You've been listening to International Connection here on 88.1. Coming up next, Aquí Nuestra America.